Good morning, Anthea.
Good morning, Sarah. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm Sarah Posner, and with me today is Anthea Butler, my colleague at Religion Dispatches, and a professor at the University of Pennsylvania.
Wow. So, what are we going to talk about today?
Well, I think we're going to talk about the election and what it means for the future of religious outreach and the role of religious groups in presidential campaigns and in elections. But first, I want to talk about David Petraeus.
I'm going to try not to laugh out loud right now, okay?
Well, you know, it's funny because as we're taping this, I'm sure there's new breaking news in this story that's captivating Washington and captivating the Washington press corps. But I wanted to focus in on one comment that was made this morning on Fox News by Mike Huckabee, who compared David Petraeus to King David, the biblical King David,
sorry, I can't
and,
help but laugh.
And King David's affair with Bathsheba. And Huckabee said, I want to be careful that we don't get so wrapped up in the scandal that we don't somehow fail to remember that most all of his career has been that of a distinguished soldier and an honorable man who made a huge mistake. But like King David, who made a huge mistake, he was still called a man after God's own heart.
Oh, wow.
Now, for anyone who's familiar with the story in the Bible about King David and Bathsheba, they might recall that it was Bathsheba's husband, Uriah, who was the military man.
Exactly.
And it was while he was out fighting King David's battles that King David seduced his wife and got her pregnant. And then he basically sent Uriah out to be killed. And God wasn't very pleased with that. If you read in 2 Samuel chapter 12, verses 1 and so on. And so I just thought that was a very curious attempt to liken Petraeus to a biblical character by a pastor who didn't seem to fully grasp that biblical story?
Clearly not, first of all. The only thing I think that's close to this biblical story is that Bathsheba was bathing. And if I think about the Cialis commercial where they have the two bathtubs, that's about the only thing that's right about this, okay? I mean,
but
listen.
We don't know that, just so everybody is clear. We don't know anything about David Petraeus, Cialis, or bathtubs.
Exactly, exactly. We know nothing. But, you know, as much as Mike Huckabee knows, I mean, his appropriation of the story is totally wrong. I mean, that's the first thing. The second thing is that I think, you know, what's so interesting about this is that the sort of normal evangelical disposition to critique anything sexual, and because this is a military Christian man, you know, the excuses start to fly far and in between. I mean, there's so much unlike, you know, David from Petraeus. I mean, first of all, Petraeus doesn't have, you know, a couple of wives, right? He only has one, who is a faithful, as all accounts seem to tell, military
right.
spouse who had to put up with, you know, this thing happening to her. So that's the first thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the second thing is that it really is amazing to me how there are double standards. When evangelicals like Mike Huckabee want to critique the world about doing things, I put the world in quotation marks, they're always sort of like, you know, and this kind of immorality happens, but the moment the immorality happens within their ranks, they try to use scripture to justify the immorality. And that's also just way out of bounds as far as I'm concerned. I mean, look, he cheated on his wife, okay? Let's just call it what it is.
Right, right. And speaking of Petraeus being a military man and a Christian man, something that I was recalling as I was reading about Petraeus, this whole scandal that's unfolding. Although, you know, to me, the infidelity part, I don't pass judgment on that infidelity part, even though, you know, it's a shitty thing to do to your wife.
Yeah.
Or your husband, you know, goes both ways. I don't know that public figures always have to resign. And in fact, public figures haven't always resigned. If you look at someone like David Vitter, you know, so, but we don't know what other national security concerns were going on here. So, but I just wanted to throw that out there in terms of, you know,
well, yeah, I think that's really
I'm not being judgmental
yeah,
about.
Especially, I was just thinking about this in terms of, you know, different kind of religious groups dealing with things.
Yeah,
evangelicals
yeah.
always want to sit you down.
Right.
You know, in the Black church tradition, what happens is that, you know, you might get a slap on the wrist, but you're back in the pulpit next week. I mean, everybody deals with this very differently. But I think the problem with this story for Petraeus is that, you know, he's over the CIA. I mean, like, dude,
yeah.
you don't know how to cheat. You're
right.
leading the CIA.
It's not the affair itself. It's the lack of judgment.
Yeah, lack
yeah,
of judgment
right.
and lack
right.
of skills.
Right. Okay, and then, but I think that perhaps Petraeus may be subjected to the hypocrisy question of, you know, using religion and using faith to as a shield. So in Jeff Charlotte's book C Street, which was the follow up to his larger book The Family, he has a section, he has a chapter about Christianity and evangelism in the military,
mm-hmm.
and he writes about a book. Called Under Orders, a Spiritual Handbook for Military Personnel, which was written by an Air Force Lieutenant Colonel William McCoy, which talks about McCoy's book talks about that there's more and more of an anti-Christian bias in the country, and that bias, that alleged bias, needs to be counteracted with religion, Christianity in particular, of course, and that that's necessary for the proper functioning of a military unit. Then Charlotte writes, McCoy's manifesto comes with an impressive endorsement. Under orders should be in every rucksack for those moments when soldiers need spiritual energy, reads a blurb from General David Petraeus, who at the time was the top military commander in Iraq. And Mikey Weinstein of the Military Religious Freedom Foundation tried to get a Pentagon investigation of Petraeus' endorsement, which, according to Charlotte's book, was an apparent violation of the Uniform Code of Military Justice and possibly the Constitution. And then Petraeus claimed that the recommendation was supposed to be a private communication from one Christian officer to another. So we do have evidence that Petraeus has claimed to be a good Christian soldier, a good Christian man, and just kind of a fascinating tidbit to throw into the mix here, given what we know now.
Now, I don't think it's assassinating him. I mean, clearly he didn't take that book out of his rucksack when he was, you know, running around Afghanistan.
Apparently the affair didn't start until after he had retired from the military, because according to military law, an extramarital affair would be a crime.
Yeah.
Although it isn't for a civilian.
Exactly. But I mean, I think the point for me is this, is that there are all these rules that they want to make, if it was outside of the military rules, there's these scriptural rules, right? And so they believe by infusing, you know, scriptural law, at least the way that they believe it, into everyday life, that's going to, you know, save people from foibles. Clearly, it doesn't. Okay, so that's the first thing. Right. And then second, you know, I think back to Mikey Weinstein and all the kinds of lawsuits and things that happen. And this stuff is just really offensive, because what ends up happening is that you have this imposition of a certain kind of Christian morality, and the morality doesn't pan out because people are human beings. It's just not useful, especially in the military. It doesn't help them.
Well, I remember interviewing a former military person who, and I had been introduced to her by some secularism activists, advocates, who were trying to lobby against or to have something done about evangelism in the military. And in particular, one of the things that they had complaints about was a military-sponsored program called Strong Bonds, which was intended to help enlisted personnel who were doing multiple tours of duty in Iraq or Afghanistan to strengthen their marital bonds. Because, of course, serving several tours of duty is difficult on a marriage. It would be difficult on anyone's marriage. But that the Strong Bonds program was very explicitly and overtly Christian, that the way to save your marriage from the trouble that might be caused by being apart from your spouse and being away at war for extended periods of time, and the stress that that puts on you individually and on the marriage, can be solved with not just religion, but a certain kind of Christianity. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's fascinating to see the military not do all that much. I mean, they've made some steps to try to counteract evangelism in the military, but that Strong Bonds is still, as far as I know, being used in the military, and they're emphasizing helping military personnel deal with their marriage, the stress on their marriage as a result of their military service. We find out this, it's just...
Can you imagine, people who've gone through this program and they've looked up to Petraeus and Kelly, and now they see this happening. I mean, it's got to make questions for them. And that's part of the issue. But I still think that it's just too much of a mix of church and the military that's funded by the state.
Right.
And it's really not acceptable. I mean, if people want to do that personally when they talk with the chaplain because they want to do this program, I think it should be voluntary. But to say that everybody should pay attention to it and they're not Christian, it's just flat out wrong. And so when things like Petraeus happen, what it does is it's two things. One is it's kind of hypocritical for us, but think about what the Afghanis must think. Think about if you're, you know, a Muslim and you're like, we have this occupation in our country, and then you hear the story. And it reinforces all of the things that, you know, imams and everybody else talks about. It's like, you know, America's terrible, immoral, blah, blah, blah. It's just like our obsession with this, with sexuality and all sorts of it, all of its forms. I mean, whether that's, you know, just anything on the spectrum has caused us to look like laughing stocks to other countries. I mean, when these kind of issues are dealt with discreetly, it's, you know, it makes for a big difference, and they're dealt with outside of these constraints of the religious bond. I mean, religious people should deal with this stuff. We should not be, you know, prosecuting all of this. Now, granted, Petraeus screwed up. I mean, he just did. But the whole way that this thing began to blow up was simply because somebody thought that this might be a way to get President Obama. And oops, you know, look what happened. They opened up the giant can of worms. Oh, no, this has come out about the guy that was
the FBI agent.
Yes, FBI agent with the other woman, yeah. So, I mean, when you start doing this digging and you come up with all these, you know, all these things about people's personal lives, you know, the moralizing that happens, I think, is just, it's the thing that sickens me the most, because I know most of these people are doing things they probably don't want anybody else to know. But at the same time, it also brings to light that we have these programs that are religiously based, but it's being forced on people, and they don't really need them. And the people who are forcing it on them are the people whose very lives are in a state of disarray.
Right. Well, the other part of this is how conservative Christians fought so hard against Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal in the military on the grounds that, you know, letting gays and lesbians serve openly in the military would be damaging to morale and would be damaging to unit cohesion. And they had all sorts of excuses and reasons.
Exactly.
And, well, anyway, but we don't know, with regard to General Allen, we don't know yet what the nature of these emails with Ms. Kelly were, and whether there was anything. It's only Petraeus who's admitted to having an affair. We don't know that.
Yeah, we still know what happened yet, but I'll tell you one thing. Anybody just should know by now that your emails are just fair game, okay?
The director of the CIA should know that.
Yeah, really. I mean, that's my biggest issue right now.
Not that it's okay for the FBI to read our emails. But no, it's on the other hand, the CIA director should know that it happens.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's move on to talking about we're a week out from the election, but I think that some of us are still kind of digesting some of the exit data based on religion, because you and I look closely at some of these breakouts of how the religion played in the election. And one of the most interesting conservatives going after each other and the recrimination blame game to happen after the election was with regard to Ralph Reed,
yes.
Who claimed, he claimed in 2008 and 2010 that there was these huge numbers of evangelicals who had stayed home and that his Faith and Freedom Coalition organization was the one to generate this huge get out the vote drive, and that white evangelicals would be the key to winning the election for the Republicans in 2012. So after Romney lost, even though he got 78% of the evangelical vote, and according to Reid's survey, white evangelicals were 27% of the electorate. And I think the national exit polling showed that they were 26% of the electorate. So it's fairly close. So even with that, why did Romney lose? Well, so Ralph Reed, of course, comes out after the election and says, well, the Republicans really need to get their act together. We did our part, but the Republicans really need to get their act together. And Steve Deese, who's a prominent evangelical talk radio host in Iowa, which, of course, is key for any Republican who wants to become president, he wrote in a USA Today op-ed, where were the 17 million evangelicals who stayed home in 2008 that Ralph Reed promised he would deliver? And then he tweeted, you can't lie. You just can't lie en masse to God's people and expect it to work. But Ralph Reed keeps trying because it pays well.
Wow. Well, I would submit to him that if he's going to accuse Ralph Reed of lying, he should start with Romney and his campaign first. But that's another story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's really interesting. I did see a stat, and let's fold this in with the Ralph Reed discussion. The evangelicals came out more for Romney than they did for McCain and Palin back in 2008.
Yes, that is true.
And I thought that was very interesting. So it just means, so something is happening, that they're losing evangelical votes to begin with. And so I think that's part of the question that's not being asked is that, you know, if he says he's going to deliver 17 million, he only delivers X million, and that doesn't happen.
Right.
But then the number goes up a little bit. Then what's happening to all the rest of those evangelicals? And clearly that means that they're not thinking about voting the same kinds of value votes that Ralph Reed and others think that they should. So that's one sort of like space that none of them are talking about. But I found Victoria Jackson, who used to be on SNL. She was the one that was even better. She had this tweet on election night that said, I hate you Christians or something like that. It didn't come out, you know. Where were all of you? So she was asking this question about they had almost the same kind of thing that the guy in Iowa was asking.
But so I'm looking at the Pew analysis of the exit polling data.
Mm-hmm.
And they say Romney received as much support from evangelical voters as George W. Bush did, and more than McCain did. You know, so McCain got 73% of the evangelical vote, and Romney got 79%. I mean, so the 6 points shifted. You know, so Obama had gotten 26% in 2008, he got 20% this time. And so, is it just a sheer numbers thing? Are they there and they're not coming out? They're already overrepresented in the electorate versus their segment of the population. I think there's something like 21 or 22% of the population, yet they're 26-27% of the electorate.
Exactly. So what accounts for that difference? I mean, you know, it also brings up the demographic question for me, is that are we talking just strictly white evangelicals? Or are we talking about other kinds of evangelicals?
We're talking about white evangelicals.
Yeah, see, that's what I figured. Because I was just like, okay, then that makes some sense to me, because we know where the other ones went.
Right.
And it was not to Romney for the most part.
Right.
I guess the question is twofold. One is that are the numbers wrong? And how you self-identify as an evangelical, is that, should that definition be changed? So that's the first thing. And that's kind of a sidebar, sort of statistical question.
Mm-hmm.
The second question I would have is it then this whole sense of the religious right evangelicals, quote unquote, don't have the same kind of clout that they used to. And is this a herald of a decline, even though they turned out more for Romney than they did for McCain and Palin? Or is it a sense in which the coalition that they've had is not holding the same way anymore?
Well, you know, it was interesting because even before the election, there were those two surveys that came out that were showing the decline of Protestants, Catholics, and maybe evangelicals, and the rise of the quote-unquote nuns, N-O-N-E-S.
Mm-hmm.
It was the Pew survey and the Public Religion Research Institute survey.
Yeah.
And both of those found a decline overall in the number of mainline Protestants, the number of Catholics, or the percent, the percentage of the population that are Catholic or are mainline, or identify as mainline Protestant and so on. I think the Public Religion Research Institute survey found a net wash of evangelicals. They were losing people, but they were also gaining people, and so it sort of came out to be even. But at the same time, an increase in the number of the unaffiliated. And that was the big religion story this fall, was the rise of the unaffiliated, the rise of the nuns, which, as a category, needs to be broken out more, because it includes atheists, agnostics, and people who consider themselves spiritual but not religious, or just, you know, there are other categories within that. And I think that needs to be broken out more, because I think that somebody who might describe themselves as spiritual but not religious, or just kind of religious but not, doesn't identify with a particular organized religion or denomination, is not the same person as an atheist. I mean, they should not be lumped in the same category.
Exactly.
But I think that the interesting part of that data and the evangelical data is this. When you look at the different age segments, so I think they have, you know, 50 to 65 and 35 to 49, I can't remember how they break it out. But when you look at the absolutely youngest demographic, that has the smallest percentage of evangelicals, the highest percentage of the unaffiliated, and within the unaffiliated, the highest percentage of atheists and agnostics as a segment of the unaffiliated. And so I think that looking at that data, that's the data that we need to follow, because are those people going to stay that way? Are there going to be people who become evangelical as they get older? Are they going to think, oh, I need that in my life? Are the atheists going to stay atheists? Those are the questions about that cohort. I think it's the 18 to 29-year-olds. That's going to tell, I think, going to tell the story about the future of religion. But because we know that there's a lot of change, you know, one of the stories about these religion surveys is that people change their religion over the course of their lives. But we don't know. I don't think that we can just generalize that, oh, you know, of course someone who's an atheist at 18 is not going to be an atheist anymore at 50. I mean, we don't know that. I think that's an assumption that a lot of people make, but I don't think that that's necessary.
Yeah, and I think it's a wrong assumption, to be quite frankly with you. I think those numbers are going to hold a lot longer than people think that they are. I mean, in part because what has really happened is it's sort of funny, but I think the evangelicals have made themselves into a bad bargain in this way. This embrace of sort of the capitalistic notions and Ayn Rand and all of this other stuff has sort of made this younger generation more individualistic rather than communal. And the kinds of communal things that evangelicals want to say, you need to come to church, all these other things, people just don't buy that anymore. They don't need it. They have other ways to connect in their lives, just like we're
thinking
right
now. The economic bargain, the economic bargain that they've made with the Republicans.
Yes, I think that's part of the why this is not going to happen for them.
Interesting.
And I would be, if I were a Ralph Reed or somebody who was running family, you know, family association, stuff like that, I would be really afraid of this younger demographic, because I think these are the people.
I think they are.
Yeah, it should be. They're tired of religion. They're tired of the, you know, they don't have the same core moral issues. You know, they may be pro-life, but they don't care about gay marriage. I mean, they want people to get married. So it's not what they envisioned this next generation would be. And they don't know how to reach this next generation because they're kind of old fuddy-duddies. I'm just going to call it. They really are.
Right.
So they don't have any mechanism to do that. And as a result, you know, these younger groups of people, you know, either unaffiliated or atheist or agnostic, are going after other means of satisfaction in their lives and have anything to do with Jesus or God. So I think that, you know, this is a real, it's not just a loss of election for Romney. It's a real crisis moment, you know, for Republicans, but it's also a crisis moment for Republicans in the way in which they married themselves to the religious right. I mean, the two things aren't really different anymore. They've already married church and state on their side. And so the same problems that the churches are having, they are going to have. That's it. And they've got, you know, it's not just demographics.
Here's their problem, though, the corner that they've boxed themselves into. Without the religious right base, and in that I'm including white evangelicals, white conservative Catholics, and white conservative mainline Protestants, because the biggest, basically the heart of Romney's base was white evangelicals, mostly, you know, more than a third of who voted for Romney, and conservative Catholics, Catholics who were buying the bishop's Fortnight for Freedom religious liberty campaign, and conservative mainline Protestants who, you know, politically speaking are more like perhaps more like white evangelicals than they may be like their denomination's official positions on things.
Exactly.
So, but what does the Republican Party do? Like, those people have said to the Republican Party, you must, you know, be anti-gay marriage, you must be pro-life, you must be this, you must be that. Otherwise, we're not going to do anything for you. I mean, and so since the Republican Party has fed this base, basically, like, yes, we're on your side, we're the Christian America party, basically. What are they going to do if they piss them off?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that they've got a real moment on their hands to figure out how to either change their messaging or to, you know, realign themselves, because I think, I mean, if nothing else, what this election did was, and if you think back, and we've both been walking through this a long time, think back to that moment when Rick Perry had the response. That looked like a totally different moment than what this ended up, right?
It's true.
And so I think that shows a huge disconnect. Just to see how Rick Perry kept trying to deploy religion, 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 and it didn't happen. And Mitt Romney said, I'm going to forget about religion, but all these people need to just come out for me anyway. And now they're left in this whole thing where we don't have a core here. So I do think...
Well, I think they... Huh? I mean, I think it could go either way. It could... And I wrote about this after, I think after the Pew survey, mm-hmm. I think after both the Pew and the public religion research surveys came out, it's, you know, essentially showing, you know, very similar, if not identical, things about the religious makeup of the population. And, I mean, I think that it could intensify the culture wars because, you know, even though it looks like the religious right doesn't have the juice to get their guy leftist, because, you know, they, in the end, they, despite the Mormon thing, they did rally around Romney.
Mm-hmm.
But it might look like that, but at the same time, they're kind of, like I said, they're boxed into that corner, and it could just make them more intensely stake out their position, because, you know, the religious right is not a movement that has ever shown a willingness to pick up its toys and go home.
Well, that's true. It,
you know, I mean, they are very intensely for their political positions. I mean, they're just, they're going to, they're, and so, in a way, it could make it less, you know, less like 2008, where you saw, I mean, even 2012 was less like 2008 in the sense that you didn't really see Obama trying to make buddies with Franklin Graham or Stephen Strang or some of these other conservative, evangelical, or Pentecostal figures.
Mm-hmm.
He kind of abandoned that. I mean, he did it maybe a little bit behind the scenes, but he didn't make a big show of it like he did in 2008.
Yeah.
And you could say that that's why he lost 6 percentage points of the white evangelical vote. But on the other hand, you could say, you know, it's because everybody realized that that was not a heartfelt, authentic thing.
Exactly. Exactly.
So I guess what I'm saying is, you know, they're going to, Obama's base or the, you know, future Democratic candidate's base is a huge chunk of the unaffiliated and liberal mainline Protestants and liberal Catholics and mm-hmm. liberal people of other religions, Jews, Muslims, Buddhists. That those two coalitions are more intensely in opposition to each other than before. I mean, it could be, I mean, not that they weren't intensely in opposition to each other up until this point, but you see what I'm saying? It's like it could make it more stark.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I was actually thinking when you were talking, you know, I think about this, the stories about all of Obama's data mining and the mm-hmm. sort of the sociologists that he had working with him.
Right.
And clearly they figured out something about this that the right hasn't figured out yet. And I would love to see the kind of data sets that they had in terms of religion and correlation with the people who would go out and vote for President Obama vis-a-vis the kind of information that Ralph Reed has. I think, you know, the president saw something coming and just said, I don't need these people. Or I can put this, you know, the kinds of people who would vote for me may have religion, but they've got some other things going on that they're concerned about. So this is sort of the X factor. I would really like to know from them how that religion correlated with all of the kinds of data mining and the data sets that they had to determine who they could get out to vote for the president vis-a-vis Romney. Go ahead.
Well, the other thing I was going to say about the New York Times piece about the behavioral scientists that they had mm-hmm. working with them, that one of the pieces of advice that those social scientists gave to the campaign was don't try to go negative on something. So like with the rumor that Obama is a Muslim, don't try to say Obama's not a Muslim. Say mm-hmm. he's a Christian. And so it made me think about what they were doing in terms of touting Obama's Christianity in a mm-hmm. different way, that maybe it was not coming from the religious outreach folks per se as a religious outreach thing, but mm-hmm. more from the behavioral scientists who were saying that this was a more positive way of communicating the reality of Obama's religious affiliation to
voters. And that also brings up a bigger issue too that I think is a huge problem for the right. And I don't know how the religious right can figure this out or not. But, you know, I know that everything is a narrative of declension and that the Antichrist is going to come and Jesus Christ is coming soon. Get ready. The world's turning worse, worse, worse. And the problem is with that is that when you run with that negative message all the time, it's just tiring. I mean, it may be part of the belief system, but it's really wearing down for people to hear that all the time. And I think when you hear these things and nothing's happening, it gets to the point where you tune it out. I mean, any kid will tell you in a long church service that, you know, the first 10 minutes you're hearing and the rest of it is just like blah, 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 like the Peanuts cartoons, right?
Right.
Or the empty bubble. And I think this is the problem for them is that they have an empty bubble right now because they've said all these things so many times and nobody's listening anymore. Nobody cares. And that may be the hardest of all. I'm sure I'll get some mail about this. But I do think that their messaging is basically, you know, really old and stale. And it may be gospel truths on the one hand. But on the other hand, the way those truths are disseminated in terms of trying to win an election for their guy who lost is really bad. One mm-hmm. more thing, too. And I think, mm-hmm. you know, maybe I'm jumping ahead to where you want to be. But I think this is hugely important. The whole discussion about the bubble that the Republicans lived in, that they could think that Romney would win. Mm-hmm. And that everybody was shocked, including Karl Rove, on election night when that didn't happen. I think that's a really big piece of what's happening on the side. When you can have, you know, when you can get your kids to listen to VeggieTales and you can, you know, see all Christian programming, everything else, and the only thing that you watch is Fox News mm-hmm. and your church, you mm-hmm. live in a very insulated bubble.
Mm-hmm.
And the kinds of things that other people are talking about or the kinds of issues that are being discussed don't permeate that bubble. And so there's no sense that they have a real sense of reality. And I would say, I'm going to throw in the Catholic bishops with this. There's no sense of reality. So when the nuns get on the bus and get the press, I know they have a little bit, they're looking going, I mean, it's like five nuns on a bus. What does anybody care? We're the bishops. But the reality is that they're a lot closer to the issues and the kinds of things that people are concerned about, poverty, than Fortnite for freedom. So
right.
this well, giant bubble is really, it's choking them off. It's killing them.
Well, yeah. And one of the statistics in terms of at least the vote was that Catholics were 25% of the electorate, but white Catholics, which was the demographic that went for Romney,
mm-hmm.
the majority of whom went for Romney, was only 18% of the electorate.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a changing demographic within Catholicism where
yeah.
an increasing number of them are of Catholics are Latino, and they're the segment of the Catholic population that went overwhelmingly for Obama, which is sort of interesting, an interesting part of the Catholic vote to remember. But with regard to the bishops, you know, they're meeting this week at they're having a big meeting this week. And I think today, as we're talking about this, they are talking about some sort of economic
mm-hmm.
statement that they're trying to put together. But what do you think that their ultimate takeaway from the election is? Because they spent the entire year, you know, with the Fortnite for Freedom and the Religious Liberty campaign and claiming that the contraception mandate was just, you know, one step towards this road towards terrible infringement on the religious liberty of American Catholics and American Christians. And clearly, I mean, not just the election data, but there's other data that shows that the mm-hmm. folks in the pews just weren't buying it.
Yeah.
Do you think they're getting the message, or do you think that they're going to soldier on?
I wish I could tell you I was going to be positive about what I'm about to say, but I'm not. And I'll get a lot of
questions
just to, this too.
Just to be clear, you are Catholic.
I am Catholic, and no, I don't think they're going to get it, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And in part, because I'll give you an example from today, just before we got on, I saw that the former bishop of the Houston Galveston Diocese, I believe Firenze, I might get his name wrong, said to them in this document that they had on economics and everything, is that they're not even referencing the previous document from the 80s that they put out about poverty, and that they only had one line about unions, where anybody knows the history of Catholicism in this country is about mm-hmm. a history of union organizing and the ways in which people got, you know, went up the economic ladder. And where the bishops had been prior to this was somewhere very different than where they are now, because they bought into sort of this Republican right-wing Protestant stuff wholesale. So he was chastising him. He said, you know, the Catholic theologians are going to laugh at us. And I'm like, we're already laughing, but okay. It's really troubling, because I think that they are at a moral crisis within their ranks. And you know that I've been somebody who's very much talked about the sexual abuse cases in the church
mm-hmm.
and what they haven't
mm-hmm.
done. I mean, that guy convicted mm-hmm. bishop sitting up there with them. So if you think, you know, that I think that they're going to change, the answer is no. However, I do think that this is a moment for them. I think they're going to double down on the healthcare mandate and try to fight that tooth and nail.
Like immigration?
Hmm?
What about something like immigration? Do you think
I think
have
they have to change immigration, or else they're going to have Latinos walking up by the churches. The Pentecostals are ready to get them. I mean, they just are. I mean, and it's already happening to them. This is where I think that the bishops are being really just dumb. I'm just going to say it. And let me look right at the screen. You guys, listen up. The Pentecostals are going to take your people. They're already taking them. Look at what happened in Latin America. If you continue not to deal with immigration in this nation, you will not have Latinos in the Catholic Church. Period. Full stop. It is just the truth. And so this issue of, you know, siding with the Republicans on a harsh immigration law, you know, everybody wants to change this now. The Catholic bishops weren't in front of this before. And I'm thinking about Cardinal Mahoney.
They were all of a sudden,
they're just like, they've lost this whole, you know, force that they had to build up this largest demographic they have in the church right now.
But weren't they for immigration reform?
Yes, they were
before.
And then
they just fell silent on it?
Yeah, they've been silent because they mm-hmm. decided to go fight the birth control battle. And they wanted to seem as though, you know, this was doubling down. And this marriage that began in the late 80s and 90s with Catholics and evangelicals has pretty much happened with this crew
mm-hmm.
of bishops.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody knows the – I mean, there's a long game that's been happening here. It's a very long game that's been happening. But the problem is for the bishops is that they don't realize that their constituency looks very different than white evangelicalism. And so you can't, you know, it's like now everybody wants Latinos. We want the Latinos. We've got to get Latinos. We've got to talk about immigration. And if the bishops don't go back to where they were, they all have to just go back to where they were. They don't even have to do anything new. They would just go back to, you know, the days in which, you know, a sanctuary movement in the 80s. All of these things that used to be amazing, where Catholic churches housed people and hid them from immigration authorities and did all these things. This is where they are wrong, wrong, wrong. And if they don't get it right this week, they're never going to get it right. And they're going to continue to see the attrition that they see within the ranks of the church. Period. Full stop.
Okay. Well, maybe that would be a good place to end.
All right.
Because I know you have a meeting to get to, too.
Well, yeah, I do. But, you know, I still want to just say one thing.
Okay.
I think, and I would like to hear what you have to say about this. I do
okay.
think what was interesting about this whole election cycle is the ways in which Mormonism came up but didn't come up.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not think that at the beginning of all of this. And I think maybe that might be the one thing that Mitt Romney did handle well in a certain sort of way. I think out of all this, the LDS church may come out a lot better than everyone else, even despite the fact that Romney lost. And I think that because now they can truly say, despite having, you know, LDS members in Congress and in the Senate,
mm-hmm.
that they still come out smelling pretty decent after all of this. I mean, Ralph Reed and all those guys may not, but I think the church really does come out in a good way.
Well, I don't think that they were, I mean, I think that there were stories about, you know, like the story about his Romney's use of a trust to benefit the church. And obviously, like, there are stories that have nothing to do with Mitt Romney and the church and its finances and so on. And, you know, yes, he was a lay bishop and a state president and all of that. But I think that there's a lot of church business, and I mean business in that sort of like literal, like business way, that, you know, is something that should be subjected to scrutiny, but not necessarily in the context of a presidential campaign, because unless it has some clear connection to the candidate. So I think that there was a lot of confusion during the campaign in the sense that, ooh, you know, here's some weird story about the Mormon church. Let's try to tie it to Romney in some way. So there was a lot of that, which I think is a bad precedent to set, because obviously we don't have a religious test for office, and a lot of people are affiliated with religions that, you know, there isn't a religion that doesn't have some hypocrisy, some scandals, some, you know, something terrible going on within it. I mean, you know, it's just the nature of things. But, you know, just like we learned during the Kennedy campaign, you can't just assume that because he's Catholic that he's going to, you know, carry water for the Vatican, or, you know, if you're Catholic that you somehow, you know, like, there are plenty of Catholics who still go to church even though they know about the sex abuse scandal. Yeah. You know, so, you know, not that we shouldn't continue to scrutinize and reporters report on and law enforcement investigate the sex abuse scandal, obviously, right? But it doesn't mean that Catholics have something to do with that. I mean, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, exactly. But I just thought it was really interesting that after all of this, that it didn't play as big of a role as people might have thought it could have.
And I think that that largely had to do with Romney himself not pushing back against something like Andrew Sullivan posting that video from the temple ceremony or something like that. I mean, the only thing we got was close to the end, something that had surfaced before, was the 2007 video of him in Jan Michelson's studio, where they talked about, you know, the church's views on abortion and the end times and all of that. And Romney was sort of heated, but I don't think he was heated in a way that damaged him. Like, it didn't seem to me that he was like, oh, you know, my church is perfect and great, and I'm just going to defend it to the hilt. I mean, I thought that sort of presented him in a sort of complicated way.
Yeah, it was just interesting to see him arguing about all that.
Yeah, no, definitely. It definitely was. But I don't think, I didn't watch that and go, ooh, you know.
Yeah, that's a bad thing.
Like, Romney's a weirdo, or, you know, in terms of the religious aspect of that. But, yeah, I mean, I don't know that the LDS Church came out looking good, necessarily. But I don't think that, I don't think it came out looking any less good than it did before the fight started. I mean, I think there are still people who look at the church's role in the Proposition 8 fight in California and view it negatively because of that. I think there are Mormons who are still upset that the church played that kind of role.
Absolutely. But I guess I mean it just a sense of that it could have turned out a lot worse than it did.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I would say. But then with that, there you go. But
anyway.
All right.
Thanks, Anthea. Bye.
Bye.